Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. I'm Peter Schiff, your host for the next hour, taking your calls live at 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. We do the show live every Wednesday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific, on my website at www.europac.net. Also on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. Don't forget, we archive the show on our website. You can listen to the podcasts. We're also uploading it onto my YouTube channel at the Schiff Report on my YouTube channel, where I also have been posting several video clips a week. If you're not checking out my video blog, make sure to do that. We have links to it on my website, and you can obviously find it on YouTube. A rather significant last couple of days in the market, I think, and confirming what I had been talking about on this show for many, many months, that the markets are beginning more rationally, that the correlations between the markets are beginning to normalize. We had relationships in 2008 that were not normal. And I believe that were one-off events, that were head fakes, that got a lot of people thinking the wrong thing and jumping to the wrong conclusion. And, the markets are funny that way. I mean, they tend to try to fool the maximum number of people. And they rarely repeat themselves. It's rarely that easy that, the market's going to do in the future exactly what it did in the past. But a lot of inexperienced money managers or people in our business are very easily fooled. They have a hard time, thinking, in forward. They can't see the future, so they simply react to the past because it's clear what happened in the past. What happens in the future takes a much bigger understanding of the macroeconomics of the markets that a lot of people, unfortunately, in the money management business don't understand. But what I'm referring to, of course, is the positive correlation that we saw in 2008 among all the various asset classes where, when U.S. stocks went down, everything went down. Foreign stocks went down, commodities went down, gold went down. There was no asset that did well other than U.S. dollars and U.S. treasuries and maybe the Japanese yen, but that was it. And I've been arguing that dichotomy, those relationships will not last, that they were a head fake, that when people initially responded to the U.S. economic crisis by looking for the safety of the dollar and of U.S. treasuries, that was the knee-jerk reaction, that was the wrong move. That was the equivalent of the running back faking left before he runs right. And a lot of people bought into that fake. And they're still buying into it. Now, of course, other people are starting to figure it out, and they're now, running in the right direction. But a number of people are still caught off guard by those events. And we've certainly seen in 2009 a big outperformance once again of foreign markets versus U.S. markets and strength in commodities and weakness in the dollar. But recently we've started to see a move down in the U.S. stock market. We've seen a fall in the Chinese stock market, which, of course, was on fire this year. And as many of you know, I recently launched a China fund, which I would recommend, the Euro-Pacific Halter China Fund. And we actually just finished the first month, although the fund has, I don't think it was out for the entire month. Our benchmark index was down about 7% on the month, whereas our fund was down 0.7%, mainly because we have a lot of cash, and we're still gradually working that cash into the market. So fortunately, this correction in the Chinese shares is happening at a good time, so it gives us a better entry point to move this money into the Chinese market. But again, we've seen strength in the foreign markets. We've seen strength in commodities all year and weakness of the dollar. But a lot of people are now looking at this correction, or rather the potential decline in the U.S. stock market. And again, they're jumping to the conclusion that, aha, if the U.S. market goes down, that the dollar is going to go up exactly the way it did in 2008. And therefore, since the dollar is going to go up, gold's going to go down, commodities are going to go down, that foreign stocks are going to go down more. And again, this is the head fake that people are buying into, which I think is laying the foundation for a wall of worry upon which commodities, foreign currencies, foreign stocks can climb. Because so many people who really lack an understanding of the big picture and of the economics involved here, are still buying into that head fake. And I mentioned yesterday in my video blog, I thought it was very interesting that when the Dow was down 185, 200 points yesterday, gold didn't go down. They tried to sell it off a couple times. It didn't go down. It actually closed on the high of the day. It was up about $5. And gold stocks were down, but they were actually down in percentage terms less than the market. Whereas normally, certainly in the big declines of 2008, if the Dow was down 2%, the gold stocks were down 5%, right? But yesterday, we had the gold stocks down, but down to a smaller percentage than the NASDAQ or the S&P. And then this morning, even though U.S. stocks did not rally, the Dow actually lost another 30 points, tacked it on to yesterday's decline. We saw incredible strength in the gold market. Gold was up better than $20 an ounce. Silver was up over 40 cents. The silver chart right now, silver is back over $15 an ounce, looking very, very strong. And gold stocks, this was the best day for gold stocks, I think, maybe since December of last year. The Huey, H-U-I, gold and silver index was up better than 9%. And there were many individual stocks that were up more than 10%. You know, Goldcorp up more than 10%. Agnico Eagle up over 10%. There were some incredible days. Harmony Mining up about 11%. A lot of major Goldfields Mining up 11.3%. You know, Kinross was up 10%. These are big, big moves in large cap gold mining stocks. Some of the other ones, Newmont was up over 9%. Barrick was up 8%. These are big moves in these stocks. And, the small stocks are up as well. Again, the overall market didn't rise. And also, I mentioned something very interesting, too, on my video blog this morning. Something else that caught my eye in today's action was not only was the dollar weak, and, the dollar strengthened yesterday as the U.S. stock market weakened. But what was noteworthy to me was even though the dollar strengthened, it didn't strengthen a lot. It was a very weak rally. Somebody was selling into that rally. I mean, the dollar was on the low end of its trading range. And with a 200-point decline in the Dow, the dollar index was not up that much. Today, the dollar lost back about 90% of what it gained yesterday, even though the U.S. stock market didn't gain back anything. But two currencies in particular stood out, the Japanese yen and the Australian dollar, up big, each up big. Now, true, there was some good economic news that came out of Australia, but the interesting thing was that both these currencies were up big in the same day. And that's not something that's happened in a long time. They have been kind of negatively correlated because the yen has been the currency that everybody goes to when everybody is selling, when they're unwinding the carry trades, when they're moving out of the riskier assets to safety. When they're worried about market declines, they're going back into the yen. So you've always seen the yen going up when the markets are down, and the other currencies going down. So when you see the yen up big, generally the Australian dollar is down big, and vice versa. When the Australian dollar was up big, the yen was down big, because the Australian dollar represents growth trade, the reflation trade. You know, the commodities are going to be strong. The economies are going to be strong. So we want to be in the commodity currencies. And so they were always acting differently. Today, there was a big move up in both currencies. And the question is, what does that mean? Is that significant? Is what we're seeing, is gold going up with the market going down, is it significant? I think there's a good chance it is. I think it's showing that those dichotomies that were established in 2008, and that so many people are convinced they're going to be repeated, because, as I said, you know, they can't think forward. All they can do is see what just happened and assume it's going to keep happening, because they lack any real understanding of the economics. Is they just assume that, well, it's going to happen again. But what's happening in some of these currencies and commodities shows that maybe that's not the case. Maybe that we're moving away from this deflation fear, or the deflation trade, to the inflation fear and the inflation trade, where it's not that, you know, investors are worried, so they're going to embrace the dollar. It's that they're getting worried and they're going to shun the dollar. They're going to embrace the opposite of the dollar, which is gold or other currencies. That this is not simply the world or investors fleeing assets. They're fleeing U.S. assets. They want out of the dollar, you know, not into the dollar. And that they rather own gold, and so these currencies are falling as a reflection of problems in the U.S., not simply liquidity concerns that we had in late 2008. Now, the bond market was actually up today, so, you know, that is not, we're not seeing this dollar weakness, you know, translate into you know, a big drop in bond prices, but, you know, I think that that is going to happen ultimately. In fact, if you look at interest rates and bond prices, you know, interest rates have been rising since December of 08. And, you know, though we haven't had, you know, a huge spike yet, I think there's a good argument to be made that the trend has turned, and that interest rates are going to be headed higher because of the inflation the Fed is creating, the big deficits, the weakness of the dollar. And at some point, and I think sometime soon, we're going to start to see a more meaningful and sharp decline in bonds, in addition to the decline we're seeing in the dollar. But anyway, let's see what happens in the days ahead. See if these breakouts are confirmed, particularly in, you know, in silver and gold, that they keep going. Can we make a new high? Can gold take out $1,000 an ounce? We're getting close again. Back up to 20. Can we get a new high for this move, the Huey, back above 400? I mean, we're getting very close. And, of course, all this could happen. You know, we are trading at around a 78 handle in the dollar index, so we're still decisively below that 80 level. And, again, you know, even with all the sell-offs in the market and people worried about a, you know, a big sell-off, and even with a rather sharp decline in mainland Chinese shares of over 20%, we've seen no meaningful rally in the dollar whatsoever. The dollar index can't even get back above 80, you know, with this worldwide sell-off. So that shows me, again, that things appear to be different, that people are starting to figure out, you know, that when there's an explosion, you don't run towards the blast, you run away from the blast. You know, also I wanted to mention something else. I happened to see this video, and I commented it, you know, about it on my video blog today. And I don't know how I came across it. I think it was on a Peter Schiff type YouTube site that I happened to look at it. And I think it's from several years ago, because at the time the national debt was about $5 trillion. So that was, you know, $5 or $6 trillion, $7 trillion ago. But this guy is interviewing this congressman, Peter Stark. And this guy is on the Ways and Means Committee. He's been in Congress for a long time. He actually went to Berkeley. He got an MBA at Berkeley. He got an undergraduate degree at MIT. So obviously the guy was a smart guy, although he was obviously brainwashed at those universities, because whatever intelligence he had certainly went out the window and didn't graduate with him. But it shows me what a difficult time I'm going to have, what a difficult task I have ahead of me in my quest to potentially enter the U.S. Senate to try to educate our leaders and prevent them from completely destroying the country. because that's what they're doing right now. If somebody doesn't go to Washington and change the mindset, change the way people think so that we can start doing the opposite of what we're doing, I mean, the country's doomed. I mean, there's no question about that. I'm hopeful that there is hope that we can change this, that our fate is not sealed. But what I'm going to have to do, I'm going to have to educate people like this Peter Stark. And I don't know, maybe he's beyond hope. Maybe he represents one of the extreme examples of the stupidity of our legislators. But, you know, hopefully, the rest of there's a lot of other guys there that are going to be easier for me to convince or persuade. But anyway, this I did tell this interviewer who was worried about the growing national debt that he didn't know what he was talking about, that there's nothing wrong with debt, that when the government has debt, it's not like an individual having debt, that it's a good thing, that the more debt we have, the richer we are, that our big debt is a sign of how wealthy we are, which is absolutely preposterous. I mean, does that mean other countries that have surpluses, that are creditor nations, that those nations are poor, that the fact that Japan is a big creditor nation, or that means that Japan is in trouble, that they're a poor country because they have all these assets? I mean, remember, the idea is to accumulate assets, not accumulate liabilities, right? When you have assets, when you're a creditor nation, you're earning interest on all your loans and all your investments. So when you're a creditor, you get income coming in, right? That's what makes you rich, having income. When you're a debtor, you have expenses. I mean, you don't become rich because you're in debt, because you have to pay expenditures. I mean, that's how you become broke. Now, what this congressman is confusing, the fact, is that sometimes it does make sense to borrow money. Certainly businesses or individuals can borrow money if they can make the proper capital investments, right? But their debt service is lower than the return on their investment. So if I can borrow at 7% and then create an asset, right, that has a return of 10% or 15%, then even though I have debt on my balance sheet, I'm not poorer because I made good use of the debt and I'm richer. But you can't take that argument that works for a corporation and attribute it to a government, because the government doesn't borrow to invest. The government borrows to spend, right? The government just spends the money. It's gone. They don't have an income producing asset. So when we accumulate debt, we just have a liability. We got to pay interest on the debt. You know, he thinks we're borrowing ourselves into prosperity when we're borrowing ourselves into bankruptcy. But you got to watch this video. It's an amazing little 5-minute interview, and it's up on my site, my YouTube site. And as I said, if you're not going to my YouTube site regularly, you can, it's youtube.com/shiftreport, right? youtube.com/shiftreport is my channel, and I favorited this interview, so you can see the thing. And the amazing thing about it is, as this individual is asking Stark logical questions about, well, wait a minute, if you're saying that debt is a good thing, that the more debt we have, the richer we are, why don't we just borrow more money? Why don't we just borrow a trillion? And when he starts asking him about, well, don't we have to pay this money back? Don't we have to pay interest? The congressman actually gets very belligerent. And he asks him, well, you know, where did you go to college? You know, and when the guy says he went to university in Puerto Rico, now he gets very condescending in the way he speaks, because, aha, you know, you only went to school in Puerto Rico. I went to MIT. I went to Berkeley, right? And he's saying, well, do you have a PhD in economics? Do you have a master's degree? And he's basically telling the guy, you got to go back to school. You got to study up on economics, because I can't talk to you, because you're a moron. You're an idiot. You're asking these simplistic questions. I mean, you don't need a PhD in economics to understand that it's not a good thing to go into debt, that, you know, a sign of how well you're doing are all the assets that you accumulate, not all the liabilities, right? It's like this guy is basically trying to argue, he brings home his report card and he's got an F, and he's trying to make the argument that F stands for fabulous. You know, who's going to buy that? We know that F is not fabulous, but that's what this guy is saying. And he's getting so mad. And at the end of this interview, he kicks the guy out. and he threatens him, physically threatens him. If he doesn't leave, he's going to throw him out the window, and he starts cursing at the guy. This is an elected official. This is a guy, a senior ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee. The guy that's in charge of writing our taxes doesn't know the difference between an asset and a liability. This is the kind of lunacy that has led this country to the brink of financial and economic ruin, and is, you know, the primary reason that I now have to potentially disrupt my career to go to Washington and to try to straighten this mess out. In any event, if you haven't donated to my exploratory committee, and you know, there's obviously quite a few people who haven't donated yet, you know, make a point of doing that within the next week or two. I think it's very important that I bring my numbers up. I want to get over $1 million raised. Right now we're, you know, not quite at 950,000. So I really want to get over $1 million. Anyway, you can do that at shiftforsenate.com. So if you want to help me go to Washington and educate these morons and try to change the course that this country is on, and believe me, we're on a very destructive course right now, then I'm going to need the money to run the campaign. I mean, sure, I'm going to spend a lot of my own money, but I've been told by people that it's going to take upwards of $20 million to win this Senate seat. And I'm not going to spend that much money. You know, I might do $1 or $2 million, but, you know, I'm not spending 20. But, you know, if I can get the money from other people, if I can get it from clients, from fans of mine, then I can wage a good campaign. And I think the interesting thing about the campaign is there's going to be a lot of people in the Republican Party that are running. And I know there's this woman, Linda McMahon, who's the wife of Vince McMahon, from the World Wrestling Federation. She's going to enter the race. I mean, that's what, you know, that's the rumors, and I'm pretty sure she's going to enter the race. And she's talking about spending $25 million of her own money, which I think will work very well for me. Because if you think about what she's going to do, she's the outsider, like me. She's not a politician. She's a businesswoman. She's never been in politics. She's never had an elected job. And so she's probably going to run a lot of ads to say, we don't want any more politicians. We don't want politics as usual. We need to send a businessman to Washington. We need to change. So she's going to basically say all the things that I'm going to say. But if people buy into that concept and they decide, yeah, we want to send a businessman to Washington. We don't want a politician. Who are they going to want to send? Somebody from the World Wrestling Federation? An entertainer? Or are they going to want to send me? I mean, my business experience is a lot more relative to the problems in the economy. I don't know whether Linda McMahon is a good businesswoman, a bad. She certainly is running a successful business. I'm not sure, you know, what her part was that in that business. I know her husband started it. Maybe she was there with him every step of the way. Maybe she's an excellent businesswoman in show business, right? She's a showman, and, you know, like a movie producer. But it doesn't mean she understands anything about macroeconomics, that she understands anything about why this country is in so much trouble or what can be done about it. She certainly might appreciate the problems of big government interfering in business. Maybe she's had to deal with a lot of regulations, but I'm sure it's nothing like the regulations that I'm operating under, having to live with the regulations of FINRA, and which used to be the NASD and the SEC and all the host of regulations that are on the financial industry. So I think to the extent that people are moved by her advertising campaign and they decide they don't want to vote for the front runner, they don't want to go for Rob Simmons or Foley, I think a lot more of those people are going to go to me than to her. I think her advertising votes for me than it does for her. Meanwhile, I'm going to be out there doing my own campaigning, my own advertising. And again, of course, as of now, I'm still not an official candidate, you know, some announcement is going to come soon with respect to that status. Because if I am going to run this thing, I'm going to have to start working relatively soon on this. I am trying to assemble a team in the event that I do make an announcement. And if I do make one, hopefully it will come soon. And again, for everybody who has already contributed, and anybody who's thinking of contributing now to my campaign at shiftforsenate.com, if for whatever reason I don't run, I've already said I'm giving all the money back. So I'm not trying to collect money here. It's not like this money is going into my pocket. If I don't run, it's going back into the pockets of the people who donated it. And if I do run, it's going to pay for the campaign. I mean, sure, in the scheme of things, the more money I raise, the less money personally I have to spend. But, you know, I'm not prepared to spend at $20 million of my own money on the campaign. I mean, I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to fall into that trap. As I said, might I spend $1 million? Might I spend two? I might, you know, depending on how things are going and if I see the money is going to make a difference. But I'm only going to be adding that money if I'm getting a substantial amount from everybody else. Anyway, let me go to the phones. I'm taking up a lot of time here. First call is Ethan from Oakland, California.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. So I've heard you talk about how Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, and I've read your father's stuff, and I completely understand why it's a Ponzi scheme. But when I try to tell people, they just don't understand it. They call me a conspiracy theorist. They say I'm lying. They say all this stuff. And could you help me, like, what would you tell them to convince them that it is a Ponzi scheme?
Well, you just have to show them how it's financed. I mean, what makes something a Ponzi scheme versus a legitimate investment is when you make an investment, the returns are generated from that asset. So if Social Security was run like a real insurance program, what would happen is they would collect the premiums or the taxes from the Social Security recipients. They would invest that money for that person. They would buy stocks. They would buy corporate bonds or some other asset. That account would grow in value, and then the income and the principal that is accumulating over the years would then be distributed back to the person in retirement to fund it, and it would be an actual asset that was viable. What's a Ponzi scheme is when you don't actually make any investments. That what happens is you take money in and you spend it, and then in order to pay a return, you need to get new investors to give you new money. That's what Bernie Madoff did. That's why it doesn't work. Ponzi schemes can never work. They always fall apart. And they're known by all sorts of names, chain letters, pyramid schemes, but they're illegal because they can't work. Well, Social Security is run on the exact same principle, and the government admits it. They call it pay-as-you-go. Well, that's what Bernie Madoff was. He was running a pay-as-you-go investment company, right? It's the same difference. What pay-as-you-go means is that when the government collects Social Security taxes, they don't invest any of the money. They just spend it. They spend it on the war in Iraq. They spend it to pay farmers not to grow food. They spend it to bail out AIG. They do whatever they want with it. And then what they do is they promise that the people who are paying these Social Security taxes, that when they reach 65, that they're going to tax some other young person. They're going to take money away from somebody else to give them their return. That's what makes it a Ponzi scheme. So it's not like it's a conspiracy. I mean, this is public information. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that the government tries to pretend to make it sound like it's not a Ponzi scheme is they say, well, no, the money isn't spent. It's invested. Here, we have it all invested in government bonds. But that's a sham. Because the government can't invest in its own bonds any more than you can write yourself a check and pretend you have an asset. You know, a government bond in my hands is an asset. A government bond in the government hands isn't an asset because it's an asset and a liability that cancels each other out. So when they say there's bonds in the trust fund, that means there's nothing in the trust fund. Because the way the Social Security trust funds would have to get money is they'd have to take those bonds and sell them. Well, if there was no trust fund, that's exactly what they'd have to do. The government would have to go into debt. So, you know, it's not a conspiracy. It's just a fact. But somehow people think that if a Ponzi scheme is operated by the government, it can work. Now, the only difference is the government can force people to participate because it's a law, right? They take Social Security right out of your paychecks. So the reason the government's Ponzi scheme has gone on for so long is because there's a law requiring you to participate in it. You know, if it wasn't a law, if Social Security were voluntary, right, it would have collapsed already. Nobody would want to pay the tax. I mean, Social Security is a good deal for the people who got in really early, who just put in a little bit of money and have been collecting. I mean, Bernie Madoff's customers that invested a little bit of money and have been taking their dividends out for the past 10 or 20 years, they made a lot of money. But the only reason they made money is because other people are losing money. So the people who got into Social Security early and the people who are still alive, who are 80 and 90, who are still collecting it, they like Social Security because they paid in a little bit and they're getting a lot. But the people who are paying the taxes now, they're going to hate it because they're going to pay in a lot and get practically nothing.
Okay, yeah, thanks. That helps a lot. Also, my second question is about upcoming bank losses. How do you think the elimination of mark-to-market coupled with extremely low interest rates will affect upcoming bank losses, because we know that when a bank has a loss, they don't necessarily have to report it.
Yeah, I think what we've done is we've enabled banks to get into deeper trouble. Basically, by eliminating the mark-to-market, there are a lot of insolvent banks that are just growing their insolvency. Instead of, you know, shrinking and dealing with the problem, we're covering up the problem so it can get bigger. And I think it's making the financial system less viable and less transparent and less trustworthy, because who the hell knows what banks are going to go under. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that the FDIC is upping the amount of insurance coverage. And I happened to be watching on CNBC the other day. They had the head, of the FDIC on television trying to tell everybody, don't worry, your deposits are safe. Nobody's ever lost any money, any a dollar on an insured deposit, and nobody ever will. And in a way, maybe she's true. Nobody has lost a dollar, but the dollar's lost value. And what I'm convinced of is that, you know, over the course of the next, you know, 5 years or 10 years, whatever it is, that there could be massive bank failures, and everybody will get their dollars back. And the government will be able to say, nobody lost any dollars. We gave everybody their dollars back. And that might be true, but those dollars won't buy anything. That's the problem. They'll be, you know, people will be using them for kindling to try to keep their house warm, because they can't afford electricity anymore. That's going to be the problem. You know, we would have a much better banking system if there was no government insurance and it was possible for people to lose some dollars, because then at least the dollar would maintain its value and people would be concerned about where they put their money, and banks would be concerned about how they invest. Instead, no one cares. Everybody takes risks, and it's going to be a gigantic disaster. Anyway, Ethan, thanks for your call.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Good luck on your Senate run if you run.
Thank you. Next up is Samir from Chicago. And, you know, I'm in Chicago. I forget the date. We're going to have a client seminar. We'll be sending out invites in October. I'm also doing a seminar coming up soon in Philadelphia, I believe in a couple of weeks. I'm speaking at a Campaign for Liberty event in Philadelphia, and I think the following day I'm doing a seminar for Euro-Pacific Capital clients and prospects. And so be on the lookout for an email regarding the Philadelphia seminar and the Chicago seminar. Anyway, go ahead, Samir.
Hi, Peter. You know, one of the things that nobody really talks about on the news, I don't know why, and it's about the Fed and how they lost the lawsuit to Bloomberg about who got the $2 trillion in emergency lending. And the Fed actually admits that if that info got out, it could cause significant harms to the U.S. economy. So any idea who got the money, what's the deal there, and why they're trying to delay, you know, they got a stay of execution so they don't have to release the info, even though they lost, even though they have a judgment to, or a court order to release it?
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with these circumstances of the, so I really don't know how to answer your question. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, let me just go to the next question, and that is about Japan's debt to GDP. A lot of people on TV are talking about, you know, how the U.S. GDP debt to GDP is getting really high, but you know, Japan's debt to GDP is actually around 200%, according to, you know, like an IMF estimate. I found it on Wikipedia. And they're number two, just below Zimbabwe. And we're
number 23 something. What is that all about? Well, first of all, you know, you're looking at various government statistics, which are not necessarily apples to apples. I mean, the way Japan calculates its GDP is going to be a little different than the way we calculate our GDP. And so I think the GDP number can be misleading as to how truly representative it is of the real size of the economy. But that said, Japan has a lot of debt. The government has a lot of debt. That is not a good thing. The reason the government has all this debt is because the Japanese government made the same mistakes that we're making. When their bubble burst in the 1980s, instead of letting the free market work, they tried to revive the economy with stimulus, and the stimulus was deficit spending. And they've been doing it for years. The result is a huge debt, and the economy is in much worse shape today than it would have been had the government not done all this deficit spending. So Japan has suffered from the government debt. But the other side of the coin is that while the government has been borrowing all this money. Japanese citizens have been saving money. And so they have the money to lend the government. Now, it would have been better had the government not borrowed all that money and it been used for more productive purposes. The Japanese people, the Japanese economy would be in better shape. But at least the Japanese have the savings on the private sector to offset all the dis-savings in the government sector. That's not the case in the United States. It's not just the U.S. government that's borrowing money. It's every American citizen that's in debt. And so we have to fund our debts by going abroad. You know, not only are the Japanese funding their government's debt, they're funding our government's debt. They're our biggest creditor behind China. You know, so that's the main difference. The Japanese owe it to themselves. We owe it to the Japanese. And their economy is based on real production and savings. It's being undermined by a big government, but despite that big government, they're still producing and they're still saving. Our economy is a gigantic bubble. It's based on the ability to go deeper into debt to buy stuff. And so that is the big problem. And the people who look at our debt and say, well, it's okay because it's small, they don't understand the big difference. They don't understand the nature of the debt and the underlying differences between the two economies. We're in serious, serious trouble. They're not. But again, they would be better off without all this government debt. I'm not saying that government debt is a good thing. I'm just saying that their economy is better able to handle all that bad government debt than our economy is.
Okay. One more question. Can I ask one more quick question?
Quick.
Okay. Do you think the problem with, you know, what's going on now is really with the people and not the politicians? Because, you know, it's hard to get elected saying that you have to raise taxes and it's going to be hard. It's going to be very difficult over the next 10 years. So, is the problem really with the people's economic beliefs and what, you know, that needs to change, and how could you do that?
Well, look, I don't know. I mean, yeah, look, democracies are difficult. I mean, the people vote for, you know, the politicians who promises them the most stuff. That's why, you know, people have defined an election as the advance sale of stolen goods. I mean, people, you know, want somebody to give them something. So it's difficult to overcome that. But hopefully we can do it. And, you know, in somebody like myself, and can get elected. But I'm certainly not going to get elected promising to raise taxes. That's not what I want to do. I want to cut spending. I want to get elected promising to cut spending, which means I'm promising to take away somebody's government check, right? So if I'm elected to the Senate, I'm going to work to stop the government from spending money, which means certain people are not going to get checks, whether they're recipients of government aid programs or whether they're government employees. That's what needs to stop. I don't want to tax people more, right? People are already taxed too much. I want to tax people less. But in order to do that, the government has to spend less. Now, that's going to mean that people are not going to get checks from the government. You know, and so that's the special interest group that I am going to have to combat. I'm going to have to let people know that they're actually worse off, that the government is giving them a check, but you know what? In the scheme of things, the government is taking from them more than they're giving to them. Everybody is focused on what they get from government, but they don't understand what it really costs. And true, there are some people in this country that really do benefit from government. There are a number of people that benefit, but there are far more people that suffer. For everybody that's benefiting and receiving some government money, there are several people that are having to pay for that. And there's a lot of problems in the economy. Like somebody looks at if the government, you know, taxes A and gives the money to B, right? You can see, well, A suffers and B benefits. But what you don't see, what about C? What if A is an employer and he decides to fire C because he had to give his money to B? You know, what about that guy? There's all kinds of people that suffer from these government transfer payments. And, of course, we have to pay for this giant bureaucracy, and it's inefficient. It's undermining our economy. I've compared it to trying to give yourself a blood transfusion from your left arm to your right arm, and you spill half the blood on the floor. So, you know, what we need to do is stop the government from taking our money. So the money can stay in the private sector and be utilized to really grow a vibrant economy, to produce goods, to provide services, and to provide employment opportunities. Anyway, thank you for the call.
Okay. Thank you.
Next up is Damien in Washington, D.C.
Hi, Peter. I wanted to ask you about what's going on with some of the commodity ETFs that are out there. I've been reading a little bit about how the CFTC do crack down and regulate and try to shut some of these commodity ETFs down. And, you know, I've been using those to, you know, try to get out of the dollar and try to invest in commodities. So I just wanted to get your response to that and what you think about it.
Well, I mean, look, we own a number of ETFs. We own several of the ones that trade in the London market on individual baskets of commodities. We also invest in a lot of, you know, commodity-type companies, and we have investments in countries that are commodity-rich and exporters like Australia, like Norway, like Canada. You know, the best thing to do to talk about these investments is to, you know, call up the Euro Pacific Capital and, you know, talk to one of my brokers. I'm sure there are plenty of brokers now that are at work, especially on the West Coast where it's only 540. If you call 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922, and ask to talk to a broker, and they can answer your questions. But thanks for the call.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, and also, too, on the on gold, you know, I really think it's important that people have gold, that people, you know, especially to have it offshore. We're selling gold through the Perth Mint in Australia, the Perth Mint Certificate Program. If you're not a Perth Mint customer, you need to learn about the Perth Mint. You should call us up to get information on how you can own gold and have it stored free of charge in a government-owned mint in Perth, Australia. The number to call directly at Euro Pacific Capital to learn about this program is 800-993-8350, 800-993-8350. Of course, I also mentioned on the show earlier the Euro Pacific Halter China Fund. Anybody interested in that, the fund is sold by Prospectus. You can obtain this prospectus and learn about the risks on the particular fund by talking to a Euro Pacific Capital broker. Right now, the fund is only available through Euro Pacific Capital. At some point, we will make it available on other platforms to other broker dealers. But right now, if you want to be in my China fund, the only way to buy it is to have an account with Euro Pacific Capital. So if you already have an account, you can talk to your broker about putting that fund in your portfolio. If you don't have an account, it's a reason to start one up. You know, especially if you're a smaller investor, it's a good way to get a lot of diversification in just one fund because we're going to have a lot of different Chinese names in there. Anyway, next up is Ted in South Lake Tahoe, California.
Hi, Peter. I'm a big fan of yours. I listen a lot, and I really enjoy your work. You're doing a great service for people out there. Anyway, I'm going to Washington next week, and I was invited by CNBC to be at their town hall meeting with Timothy Geithner. My question is, if you were to be there, what would you want to ask him?
Oh, I mean, there's so many things I'd want to ask him, including, you know, when's he going to resign? But, you know, I mean, Geithner, you know, I'd say, why are you repeating that? Why are you repeating the same mistakes of Hank Paulson? You know, everything that he's doing is wrong. But again, you know, he's probably operating from a perspective of, I want to help out my friends at Goldman Sachs. And so if that's his goal, he's doing a good job. I mean, we're transferring a lot of wealth. You know, guys like Geithner have convinced Congress that the future of our economy rests on massive bonuses being maintained at Wall Street investment banks, that if we don't maintain the financial services part of our economy, that we're all going to come crashing down. But the reality is the solution to our problems involves the bankruptcy of a lot of these companies. One of the problems with our economy is that finance is too big a part of it, that too many people are making too much money shuffling paper around, speculating, you know, on cheap credit. In order to have a real vibrant economy that benefits the middle class, right, where, you know, we can become more productive, we have to let that phony financial bubble fully deflate. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, I'm against people earning a lot of money. I'm all for it. I'm against people earning a lot of money with government subsidies, with bailouts. I want people to earn money in a free market where they're getting paid for their successes, not getting rewarded for their failures. That's what's going on right now. So when I'm attacking, you know, the big bonuses on Wall Street and the big checks, it's not because I'm a socialist trying to say it's not fair that people should earn a lot of money. you know, I'm all for people earning a lot of money, as I said. But what I'm not for is the government taking money away from the middle class and handing it to the rich. That, I mean, you talk about your reverse Robin Hood, stealing from the poor and giving to the rich. I mean, that's what the government is all about right now. That's what Geithner represents. That's also what my potential opponent, Chris Dodd, represents. She'll get the Republican nomination, which is one of the reasons that I would be looking forward to that race, because I think it's going to be very fun to paint this person as, you know, as the enemy of the poor, the enemy of the middle class, the champion of the Wall Street fat cat, because that's
what
he is.
You're going to be running on a platform of fiscal responsibility, and as you mentioned before, you don't want to raise the taxes, but you want to cut the spending. I did a little figuring as to what it's going to cost every American if we're actually to pay off the debt, making the assumption that in 10 years we're going to owe about $33 trillion plus some unfunded liabilities from Social Security and Medicaid. But actually, if we were to pay it off, every man, woman, and child in America would have to pay about $1,166 per month for the next 10 years. Now, I've got five people in my family. That's about, what, $5,800 a month for me.
Yeah, I mean, look,
it's not
I understand.
Happen.
Look, there is no way we can repay the debt. It is virtually impossible. The math doesn't work, right? So I don't want to repay the debt, right? What I want to do is I want the government to work with our lenders on a restructuring of the debt where there's a write-down of the principal to some manageable amount. Because the alternative is that we just print a bunch of money and wipe out everybody. So on the present course, our creditors are going to get nothing, right? We're just going to print money and give them worthless paper. But in order to inflate our way out of debt, we're going to destroy the middle class. We're going to bankrupt this country. I would rather have an honest discussion with our creditors and be honest and admit, you know what? We screwed up. We simply borrowed too much money. I mean, the government should do the same thing that they're saying with the homeowners. Hey, you know, you guys got misled. You guys got suckered in by predatory lenders. I mean, that's the same thing. The Japanese and the Chinese, I mean, they're not blameless in this thing. They loaned us too much money. They should have cut us off decades ago. But the fact of the matter is,
I'll ask Geithner if he thinks that we ought to try to renegotiate our debt. That's one way to pay it off.
Well, it's better to do that. It's better to offer our creditors 25 cents on the dollar, you know, than to give them nothing with a printing press. And, you know, that's what's going to happen, right? We're going to have this massive inflation if we don't do something. We've accumulated too much debt. As I said, I don't give the Chinese and the Japanese a pass in that because they enabled it. They knew that we were spending the money. They knew we weren't investing it. They should have been more responsible as lenders and refused. And it's mainly government to government. I mean, the U.S. government borrowed all this money from the Japanese government and the Chinese government. Why should American citizens be obligated to pay that back? I mean, we didn't vote for it. I didn't want these deficits. You know, my children didn't want these deficits. So, you know, it's an impossible burden that the government is placing on the citizens. The citizens, you know what? We're not gonna honor these commitments. And that I think that's better for everybody because the numbers are just too high and they're going to be too high. And that's the same thing with our contingent liabilities. The government we cannot keep the promises we made. We can't pay all the Social Security benefits that we promised to pay. What I would want to do is reform the system so that the people who really need the money, who are now completely dependent on the money because the government bred that dependency, they need to get some money. But we need to make sensible changes so that that can happen. A lot of people that are getting Social Security checks, you know, they're not going to be able to get them because if we don't stop the payments to people who don't need it, no one's going to get it because it doesn't work. The baby boomer can't have their Social Security. They bought into a lie. No more than Bernie Madoff's customers can get their money back. Ponzi schemes don't work. So sometimes just look, we promise more than we can deliver. We can't pay back our creditors. We can't make commitments on Social Security and Medicare. So we've got to find a way to restructure these obligations in the most responsible way possible. And now moving forward, stop distorting the economy. I mean, one of the reasons that so many Americans need Social Security is because the government taxed them so heavily when they were working, they couldn't save for their own retirement. What we need is for the government to let Americans who are working keep their money and don't encourage them to go out and buy things on credit cards and take out loans to get new cars. People need to save their money and plan for their own retirement. because if you're planning for your own retirement, you'll actually fund it. You'll actually have legitimate investments. The whole idea behind Social Security is the government said that Americans were not responsible, that we were too stupid to plan for our retirement, that the government had to do it for us. So the government taxed us under the idea they were going to take the taxes and invest it. We know what the government did? They didn't invest a penny. The government spent every dime. The government did exactly what they were afraid American citizens to do. In fact, the government did worse. The government didn't save anything. I mean, imagine if individuals had been able to keep all those payroll taxes that they paid and that their employers paid on their behalf. And that's another con. The government wants you to think that someone costs you 7%. It doesn't. It's 15%. Because the portion that your employer pays, that comes out of your paycheck. So if Americans had had all that money, they could have actually invested it.
Right.
But instead, the government didn't invest any of it. Yeah. Anyway, thanks. I'm starting to run out of time. Thanks for the call. Got two callers left. I'll try to get to both of you. These will be the last two calls. Next one is Ted in Atlanta, Georgia.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, Ted. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, like a lot of people, I've been trying to figure out why the foreign banks still have an appetite for U.S. Treasuries. And I just read an article called The Fed Shell Game, and I just want to get your comments on it. In this article, he makes the he concludes that what's going on is the foreign central banks are basically swapping their agency debt for U.S. Treasuries, whereas we've seen the Fed balance sheet. What's that?
I read that article, and those are some valid points. And what he's talking about is the reason that foreign central banks are still buying treasuries is because they're selling their agency paper, and that stuff is being bought up by the Federal Reserve. So they're getting out of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac debt, or they're maybe getting out of other U.S. assets or other structured debt, credit card debt, auto loans, and they're buying treasuries. One of the other points that they make, which is a valid point, is that foreigners have been shortening up their maturities. They've still been buying U.S. treasuries, but they've been buying the shorter end. And they've been, you know, as their long-term bonds are maturing, they're moving to shorter maturities. And this is in preparation for an easy exit. Because the thing is, if our creditors owned a bunch of 30-year government bonds, the government doesn't have to pay the principal back for 30 years, which means if our creditors want to get out of those bonds, they have to sell them on the market. They have to find a buyer. And if everybody is trying to sell, the bond prices might collapse. They might go down to 30 cents on the dollar, 20 cents on the dollar in a secondary market, right? Which would mean they would take a huge loss in their principal if they tried to get out when there was a panic, right? But if they own treasury bills, if they own six-month bills or one-year bills, they don't have to worry. They just let them mature, and they get their money back. And so if they're shortening up on their maturities, in essence, they're preparing an exit strategy because they're no longer locked in. They can get out whenever they want because they don't need a buyer. They don't need liquidity because it's yours and we have to pay up. Like, so when you borrow for 30 years, when the government takes money, they borrow $1 million with a 30-year bond, they don't have